Fairhurst, for inviting me to, as a representative from Experiment Land. It's quite an honor to be here, quite a pleasure to be at the Perimeter Institute. I was planning to talk mostly about LIGO and Virgo until I read Luis's email, where he suggested that I'm going to represent the field, and from the perspective of numerical relativity and data analysis, the field I choose to interpret as broadly as possible, as anything that might see a gravitational wave. This is for two reasons. One reason is because it gives me a chance to talk about some experiments that I think are really fun, neat, and interesting. And the other thing is because I got lost on Thursday walking through the halls of the Infinite Corridor, and I found this, which you can't see at all. I apologize. It's Wile E. Coyote. He has run into a brick wall at the end of a corridor. It's actually at the bottom of a set of stairs, so you can really get up some speed running into that Wile E. Coyote. And my point is that we're at a really wonderful time in gravitational wave detection where there's a lot of different ways that we may see gravitational waves, and I don't want to focus on any particular one of them because that one may not prove to be the first or even the most interesting. So I'll talk today about, I'll kind of go from low frequency to high frequency and start with the cosmic microwave background, then pulsar timing, LISA, and space-based missions, which have some interesting news recently, from my perspective anyway. And then I'll talk about more of my bailiwick, the ground-based detectors, LIGO, Virgo, and some future progress. Should I move this in some way? Is closer to my mouth? And of course, because I'm going so far afield, I have to ask special thanks to a lot of folks who've provided me with some slides and material. So from the cosmic microwave background perspective, this is the WMAP 5-year temperature map. We've seen it quite often, and we've also seen the higher order multipoles here as the density fluctuations, the acoustic fluctuations from the CMB. That doesn't tell us a whole lot about gravitational waves. It tells us a lot about inflation, but buried in this signature is polarization info. And to give a sense of how difficult challenging this is, of course, it took 30 years to see a map as pretty as this, and in terms of temperature squared, which is the power in each multipole, the anisotropy is something like 6,000. The polarization signal is something like 0.5. So it's a much, much weaker signal, much more difficult to see. In fact, the normal microwave background signal is one of the dominant backgrounds. If you can see the polarization signal, you get a probe of the Thomson scattering from the surface of last scattering. And Thomson scattering just takes unpolarized light, say from a hot spot, and scatters it off of an electron here. And we are observing along this line of sight. So this is the line of sight to the surface of last scattering. Now, if there's an anisotropy in the scattered fields, so if there's a hot spot that makes higher amplitude electric field and a cold spot which makes lower amplitude electric field, along our line of sight, that ends up looking polarized. So you have to have this pattern of hot and cold in order to make a polarization effect, and there are two dominant types of hot and cold. The one type just comes from the so-called scalar mode. It's just because of velocity flows in the plasma, and that gives you an M equals zero quadrupole moment, which looks like the TE field polarization. The one that's interesting for us is gravitational waves. In this case, this is from Wayne Hu, who is showing a gravitational wave passing sort of upwards this way. And as the gravitational wave distorts the plasma in this ellipse shape, you naturally get an M equals 2 quadrupole. It's called the tensor mode quadrupole. And that quadrupole is visible in the cosmic microwave background if you can see the polarization of the cosmic microwave background. The m equals zero quadrupole, the velocity flow term looks like terms like this. The m equals two terms from gravitational waves have a net curl to them. So they're sometimes called the B-mode polarizations in analogy with the curl of the magnetic field. So this is from Matias Zaldarriaga. This shows sort of what a polarization field might look like in the CMB if you had the resolution to see it. And if you can see it, it carries two imprints of gravitational waves. The first comes from gravitational waves from inflation, where the scattering comes within the CMB itself. And the second place where you might see gravitational waves is actually from the epoch of reionization at later times, where it's the gravitational waves from inflation are making a density fluctuation of the plasma that then scatters the CMB. And so if we project what that might look like on the CMB sky, we can again do a function of multipole moment here, L, and this is a function of temperature. And now to set the scale, both of these plots are the same scale. Here's one microkelvin here at the top. So this was the small signal we saw in the WMAP data. This is the TE cross-polarization data. And down here in red and blue are the B-mode polarization from gravitational waves. The low multipole moments here are from the last scattering surface, and the higher moments are from the reionization. Now, of course, this is one of those cases where one man's trash is another man's treasure. Most of the CMB folks who are looking at this are interested in using it for weak lensing surveys to measure the mass of the universe, which is this green line. There are also a lot of folks who are looking at synchrotron emission and dust, which are the primary things which might hide the B-mode polarization signals. But you know, if the dust works out in the universe and the synchrotron emission works out, and we can with good fidelity subtract those foregrounds, then for instance, Planck has got a very good chance of seeing B-mode polarization from gravitational waves. So Planck has been on orbit now for a couple of years. It's at L2. They're kind of in penalty time. They get another year of observing. The ESA just gave them another year of operations. And they expect to produce their first sky maps in 2012. So CMB is kind of one of the, maybe from my perspective, surprise most exciting places to look for gravitational waves. And the other thing about CMB compared to ground-based detectors is they really have a lot of experiments both in the air and the ground, and they really have very good names for their experiments. So they've been very competitive in their naming schemes. Another sort of different flavor of gravitational wave detection is pulsar timing. Again, I'm sorry this doesn't maybe show up as well as it should, but the way pulsar timing works is you have an array of distant pulsars that you can measure the timing residuals of very accurately here on Earth in the center. As the if you can monitor the residuals for these different pulsars, they will fluctuate because of passing gravitational waves. And this is, a completely different frequency band. Instead of looking at gravitational waves that are basically the size of the universe, you're looking at gravitational waves that propagate with a period equivalent to your observation time. So these gravitational waves have periods of 5 or 10 years. If you want more information on it, you can read one of the original articles from Stephen Detweiler, or you can talk to Stephen after this, and he'll tell you all about it. For now, I'll tell you that it's been a kind of a resurgent field in the last few years. There are now many pulsar timing arrays. This is the European pulsar timing array, which has 5 of the largest telescopes in Europe. The Parkes pulsar timing array from Australia, and NanoGrav here in the United States using, here on the North American continent, using the Green Bank Telescope and Arecibo. They've all joined forces together, and they're now a part of the International Pulsar Timing Array. To give you a sense of the feasibility of this method, Andrea Lohmann and her collaborators calculated the and Frederick Genet calculated the timing residual you would observe from the motion of this supermassive black hole binary, possible supermassive black hole binary. And this binary, you can see, is orbiting each other with something like a couple of year period, so it's causing a couple of year gravitational wave. Well, I think actually the binary orbit is this long one, and this period is the Earth's motion. And you can see this timing residual here is plus and minus 10 microseconds, and it's observed for about 7 years. This is the simulated residuals if everything were lined up nicely. This is residuals from timing data for this pulsar here, and you can see that the residuals are something like 10, better than 10 microseconds. So for a single pulsar, we have the right kind of timing. You need a pulse. You need many pulsars in order to reconstruct a gravitational wave signal. The nanograv experiment discusses having 20 pulsars with 100 nanosecond residuals. Right now, there's only a few pulsars with that kind of timing. So there's work to be done. But if they can find the pulsars and find the telescope time, then by 2015, they can have a sensitivity curve that looks something like this, where in gray here is massive black hole binary and spirals. And pink here is from cosmic strings. The full pulsar timing array, international pulsar timing array, by 2020, after a 10-year observation, might do something like this. And that's to be compared, of course, to LISA and LIGO. So that's quite exciting. Of course, they have some sort of technical things that they've done as well. This is timing that has been achieved at the Green Bank Telescope, where they've been timing an individual pulsar, and they have a new back end called Guppy, which is called the Green Bank Ultimate Pulsar Timing Precision Instrument. Thank you. Again, they're very good at their names. The punchline is that you go from red to green here, so definitely sub-microsecond timing over the span of a few days. Now they just need to apply it for several years. And if they, here's a different projection of that map. They've been integrating for a few years with sort of 100 nanosecond timing. In the end of 5 years, they expect to be seeing black holes ruling out some models at any rate. And if they have the upgraded detector, I believe this is 30 pulsars with some more observation time and some better residuals, they really have a very good chance to see gravitational waves. I'm not sure what this is. They do talk about seeing, I'm not sure explicitly what this plot is made to represent. They do consider both a stochastic background of gravitational waves, in which case it's a very competitive measurement. They also consider seeing individual in spirals. So it's both. I'm not sure which one this is. Other questions? So, on to LISA, getting a little closer to home for me. This has got lasers in it, and a curve that we all sort of seen. Just to understand the curve a little bit, at high frequencies, the sensitivity is rolling off because of the round trip time between three satellites in orbit around the sun and trailing the Earth's orbit. At low frequencies, they're sensitive to acceleration noise. And, of course, these are quite long frequencies, so this is noises that happen in your detector on the order of several hours, very difficult to suppress here on Earth. And then this position noise here is effectively where the laser comes in and just contributes right at their bucket, as you would. This is assuming a year of an integration time. The LISA mission is pretty straightforward as far as a gravitational wave detector. You have three satellites. This is just showing the link between two satellites. You trade a laser in between the satellites and measure the position between each spacecraft here, SC is spacecraft. And then on each spacecraft, there is an inertial test mass, this little black box, and you do a measurement between the spacecraft and the test mass, and you can reconstruct the timing in between these two spacecraft. Once you have three spacecraft and you have the timing information between each link, you can reconstruct basically any geometry interferometer you like and cancel out all of the technical noise sources that they have, many of the technical noise sources. Much of the LISA hardware exists. This is the actual interferometer package on the satellite being put together at Glasgow. This is the sensor unit that measures the distance between the spacecraft and the test mass, which is shown here. And the test mass is just a little cube. So if that were the mission, there wouldn't be much more to say. But of course, there is a mission called LISA Pathfinder. LISA Pathfinder is a mission to prove that you can get the relevant acceleration noise on orbit. It's a single satellite mission that will demonstrate within about a factor of, maybe a factor of five, the required acceleration noise for LISA. Here is what the requirements of the LISA Pathfinder mission were. Pink here is what they project they will actually be able to do. And perhaps most interesting is they are scheduled for the third launch of the new Vega rocket in the second half of 2012. So by large project standards, that's very, very soon. To that end, they have built up the spacecraft. This here this piece here is the heart of the spacecraft. It's called the LISA test package. Here is the interferometry aspect, which is very similar, same construction, same pieces as LISA. And here are two test masses with their housing and everything, and that as well as a LISA design. They have the LISA phase meter, which does the measuring, LISA lasers, LISA optics, et cetera. You get the picture. And of course, from a hardware point of view, all of these things now exist. The last thing to not exist is the actual test mass assembly itself. And it's for a remarkably prosaic reason. It's because the caging assembly that holds the test mass during launch, it turns out to be really tricky and really quite hard. Here's a trick for it. It's the key mechanism that is outstanding. It's on the critical path for the delivery of the test package, which is therefore on the critical path for the delivery of the flight hardware. Almost all the rest of the flight hardware exists and is being integrated at Astrium in the UK. Here it is driving around on its own truck. I don't know why it gets its own truck, but on the side here is what's called a micro-Newton thruster, which is the new technology that is one of the new technologies that the Pathfinder is demonstrating on orbit that can show the residual acceleration noise required. In pink here is the requirement. In blue here is what they actually measured. And you can see it basically meets the requirements at all places except up there where it's limited by the facility. Again, if that were the story, it'd be all well and good, but there is more gravity going on in orbit. This is a little bit more prosaic from a gravitational wave perspective. This is the GRACE mission. It's the Gravity Recovery and Climate Explorer. It's two satellites that fly around the Earth, and you measure the distance between them. That allows you to make a gravitational map of the Earth and is being used to do fun things like look at the gravitational defect after the Sumatran earthquake. So this is the mass rearrangement in Indonesia. This is microgal, so a gal is 9.8 meters per second squared. This trend here is looking at the mass, effectively, of the Greenland ice sheet, and it's been decreasing over the last, in this case, 4 years, but it's now a 7-year data set. This mission has been so successful and is due to end soon that NASA and its partners are kind of scrambling for a replacement. called GRACE-C. And what they've noticed is that GRACE measures the distance between spacecraft, and LISA measures the distance between spacecraft. So they're very, very observant folks. And so what they'd like to do is actually put some LISA interferometry on the GRACE-C mission. The thing that's, of course, remarkable about this is that this is a complete fast-track project. Just to compare the two projects, you know, LISA's 5 million kilometers. you know, it hardly even says. The LISA folks, when you talk to, you know, you get excited to them, you're like, hey, you're going to fly some lasers. And they say, yeah, but it's so easy, you know. LISA has this 12 picometer per root hertz requirement. The GRACE mission is 50 nanometers, so it's almost too easy for them. They're embarrassed to be playing. On the other hand, it's a complete fast-track mission. They expect to launch this thing at the end of 2015, early 2016. So that's, you know, zero to launch in something like 4 years. So that's quite an exciting thing. And they intend to follow on with GRACE follow-on missions that will require the better sensitivity of the laser link. So on to the ground, a place where we're a little more comfortable. You've all seen this plot before. Many of you are probably actually members of one of these collaborations. If you're not, yes, sir. It's to continue the climate research. The main goal, the question was, what's the main goal of GRACE-C? And it's things like this trend. For instance, the Greenland ice sheet, it's the best measurement of the Antarctic ice sheet. It's the best measurement of sea level. It's the best measurement of, you know, glacial loading in the Himalayas. It's really hard for people to argue with this data. it's just wonderful data. And much like everything in the climate research, it really benefits from having a continuous record. So the problem with the GRACE mission is it's flying in kind of low Earth orbit, so it's continually slowing down and being adjusted and things like that. So it has expendables, and the mission's going to end at some point. There's a second mission that's in the middle called. I actually don't know how to pronounce it. It's G-O-C-E, but it might be pronounced Goche or Ghosh or Goch. Or anyway, but it's just a single satellite with a single inertial test mess on it. So it has a different set of capabilities. I don't know how it compares to GRACE in detail. But, you know, it's nice that from sort of a... all of the LISA technology is getting used as tools by other communities and is viewed just as standard. So I think that can only be a good thing from our perspective. So, as I was saying, if you haven't joined one of these collaborations yet, I congratulate you. That's a great achievement. So this is a timeline for sort of LIGO, Virgo, GEO, which have all sort of combined and formed a larger collective. We share data, we share science runs, et cetera. Green here is kind of showing science runs schematically from, say, 2005. This big green run here is the LIGO first data run. It's the initial LIGO and with some months of Virgo. Run. We sort of achieved something like 15 megaparsecs of in-spiral range. That's kind of the average distance we could see in in-spiral 2. And we had 1 year of triple coincidence for the LIGO interferometers, several months of coincidence with Virgo, and GEO was running for most of that time, too. At the end of somewhere in the middle of this period in 2006, we started looking ahead and saw this hard red line here, which is the detector handoff for advanced LIGO. That's when we turn initial LIGO off and we take everything out of the vacuum system and we build the next generation of detector with a factor of 10 larger noise. And we said, well, it's time to test out some of that hardware and infrastructure in what we call the S6 run or VSR2, where we've improved the sensitivity by about a factor of 20 and we're getting some triple coincidence. And this feels quite a lot like Mr. Coyote again. The fuse is burning, we're riding the rocket, we're just hoping for a very good end, so we want to make everything happen as smoothly as possible and learn our lesson. And so there's been an intermediate generation of detectors, the plus detectors. For instance, GEO-HF is increasing their laser power, working towards the high-frequency tuning, some of which we talked about yesterday, and particularly working on squeezed light injection, which is a method to improve the shot noise performance. Virgo Plus is hopefully wrapping up very soon. They increased their laser power, changed some of their optics specifications, and most importantly have gone to what's called a monolithic suspension, which allows them to reduce their contribution from thermal noise at low frequency. So they're in progress. And then Enhanced LIGO tried to roll out as much advanced LIGO technology as possible, as early as possible. The probably most significant one of those is we moved the gravitational wave readout into vacuum on a seismically isolated platform, and we changed the readout scheme to DC readout, which is the new advanced LIGO readout scheme. We also increased the laser power, changed some of our suspensions, and tested a new computer system, the advanced LIGO computer system. So some of what that looks like, this is the GEO squeezer. Again, you can't see it. There's not a whole lot to see because this large box is absolutely chock full of optics. There isn't a spare inch on that box. And the whole point is to again, be able to inject squeeze light into the interferometer. They successfully injected squeeze light into the interferometer. Unfortunately, they went from a low noise curve here to a high noise curve by the injection of that light. So, the first effort was, was a check. You know, these interferometers are wonderful machines, and you can't do anything to them without making them worse, unless you then put a lot of work into making them better. This is a very recent result from just a week or two ago. It's been better since then. But this is showing the noise before in blue here, and in red is after they attach the squeezer. So this is better than the plot. They have not yet locked the squeezing angle. So and most of the time the squeezer is making the noise situation worse. But every once in a while it suppresses the shot noise. And you can see right here the squeezer is suppressing the shot noise for about a half a second, which, again, in this business, we consider a huge victory, and there was much celebration and rejoicing. That's an ongoing work. The GEO-HF is positioning itself to be the most sensitive and only detector online during that period between initial LIGO and advanced LIGO, and initial Virgo and advanced Virgo. From Enhanced LIGO and Virgo Plus. So again, I mentioned before that Virgo Plus changed their suspensions. All of their optics are back in their vacuum system. Their interferometer is back together and robustly locking. That means that they're now at a point where they're doing the fine tuning and noise hunting that gets you that last factor of a few. I hesitate to show any of their noise curves. That's their prize that they get to deliver. But they're on track to rejoin the LIGO detectors towards mid to end July. And then finally, Enhanced LIGO has been running since about this time last year. We've been running with DC readout and high power. This is the running that we got yesterday. You can see that during the nighttime at Louisiana is in green and Hanford is in red here. We're doing quite well at both sites. It's really quite wonderful, 20 megaparsec range. During the daytime, not so well, 15 megaparsecs or 0 megaparsecs. And I guess all I can say is that I'm very glad to know this now and not with an advanced LIGO. This is what the last year of data has looked like. We started, particularly at Livingston, a little poorly, and then have done continuous commissioning breaks in between to improve the detector. And all of the commissioning that we've done is applicable to advanced LIGO. So that's been the main benefit, I think, of enhanced LIGO. We were hoping to get to such good sensitivity earlier and be more astrophysically relevant. Perhaps Stephen and Duncan talked about that earlier this week. I'm sorry I missed it. But we've already commissioned the advanced LIGO DC readout scheme, thermal compensation schemes, data acquisition systems, in-vacuum seismic isolation, high-power lasers, high-power modulators, a new feed-forward style. So all this is work that we don't have to do next year. So the truck continues on. The NSF schedule has us taking apart our detectors, beginning the morning of October 20th, 2010. The crews arrive with the pickaxes and start taking anything out. If there are pieces you want, you can put in your request now. You may get them. You may not. The project milestone has got April 2013 as the completion date for the third interferometer installation. And what that means is the last bolt has been put onto a vacuum system and the last cable has been plugged in. And if all things were equal, we could turn the big red button and get interferometer. The acceptance review is about a year after that. That's November of 2014. And acceptance in project speak means a locking interferometer. There are no claims about detector sensitivity. And part of that is because we like to think that we've learned from our history. This is a cautionary tale for all of us. This is sort of the initial LIGO acceptance. It's off the top of the chart here in terms of strain. It was in May of 2001, and it took almost a full 5 years to get to what we eventually achieved in April of 2005. And even this curve from 2005 improved by another 50% over the course of the science run. Virgo had a very, very similar story. Their first locks were up here in 2003, and it wasn't until late 2009 that they really achieved something that was close to what they were aiming for. We are doing everything in our power to shorten that time. That was why we did Enhanced LIGO. That's why we did all of these projects. On the other hand, I think that, it's most realistic to expect a similar type situation once we have our detectors in the vacuum and working. And what that might look like is a series of science runs where the interferometers continually improve, and a reasonable guess, speculation on where we might start is with ranges that look something like 60 megaparsecs, then 140, and then 200. And where those numbers come from is something like this. This first configuration here in green is essentially the same configuration that we're running in today with better seismic isolation. So it's the same optical configuration as this is a curve from yesterday, actually. It's the same optical configuration. It's the same power levels. It's just a better seismic isolation. So it gives us this extra region down here. But we don't claim to achieve our final seismic isolation until maybe that second science run where we've figured out what's going on at low frequency, and then eventually we'll get to our final curve. And of course, what we've discovered is that when there be monsters, they be down here, and that's the land we've never explored before. We believe we know what's going on at high frequencies. So if you haven't seen these curves yet, I don't know where you've been, but here you go. This is what the LIGO project is putting forward as design. I think the term is anticipated sensitivities. This run here that's called NOSRM, this blue one is the data that I showed on the previous slide. Where all I did was add an extra factor of a few to the low frequency performance. So in terms of evolution of the detector, it's likely that we will go for this blue curve first and this green curve here second, and then this red curve. So that's, but of course, you know, no one is willing to make a commitment to any timetables or specific geometries. We have to see what monsters there be first. Again, in terms of project speak, this is a graphical representation of some numbers that have something to do with our project. I actually don't know what the numbers on this scale are, but I am pretty sure that this is time along this axis. But I'm not sure if these are fiscal years or real years or, you know, some other years. We're somewhere in this pink box. We've accomplished about 26% of our project, which is in the neighborhood of where we wanted to be. The top curve, of course, is the one we're supposed to be on. The lower curve is the one we actually are on. Cleverly, though, because we planned our detector so well, there's an economic downturn on. I don't know if you've noticed that. I hope you have. But just because of the cost of aluminum, we're 6% under budget. So, you know, sometimes you get lucky. At this point in our experiment, all of our subsystems are in fabrication or have been fabricated or are in their final design review. So we're planning to be ready to take our detector apart. And of course, this, you know, standing army normally has other connotations, but we have three detectors full of optics here. This is input mode cleaner. Full of sensors. These are seismophones for the in vacuum seismic isolation. These are accelerometers for the in-air seismic acceleration. These are hydraulic pumps. So if you were to visit our observatories now, you would find them just full of stuff. In fact, the inventory control is a real problem. and it's also a real problem sometimes in procurement. This is one of those seismic isolation tables, and you can't quite see it, but that's a crane lifting things up. And these are folks in a clean room in a bunny suit. It's difficult to build things with cranes and bunny suits at the same time. This one, I'm sorry, the lights are a little bright. You can't see it. But this is all of the seismic instruments. This is a pallet worth of seismic instruments. They're about 20 kilobucks a pop. They all, of course, have fragile labels on it, and the forklift driver managed to put both tines of a forklift through fragile labels. So, you know, how he managed to hit that geometry by accident, frankly, beggars the imagination. In terms of testing, we're a fair bit of the way through final testing of all of our optics. This is the punch line. This is a 40 kilogram test mass that is monolithically bonded to what's called the penultimate mass here. The test mass has nothing touching it except a gold electrode. The gold electrode is not on the test mass. The test mass has nothing monolithically bonded fibers here. These are quartz fibers that hold the family jewels, as it were. That's a pretty scary thing to have your million-dollar optics suspended from a piece of 100-micron glass. So of course, all the experimentalists in the room demanded that the monolithic suspension folks test their apparatus in detail. This is the Virgo test from our colleagues in Pisa. You can see the test mass here. If you can see that thing flying in from the outside, that's a hammer that he's hitting it with. And the demonstration, of course, is that these systems, in spite of their awesome performance, their, you know, their 10 to the minus 19 meters performance, can be whacked with a hammer. And of course, you know, so this is the Virgo group doing this, and all of the LIGO folks went to our people and said, so why, you know, what are you guys doing? And so they started whacking their stuff with hammers, and for a little while, everybody was whacking everything they had with hammers. You know, they're like, finally. And so we show this plot a lot, this image a lot. This is, again, this is our four detectors that have been running for the last few years. Trust me, there's land over here. It's called Australia. and this little light up here is Japan. There's been, I think, in recent days, fantastic news from both places. So I like to call it Australian Advanced LIGO so that I get to call it LIGO. Other people call it LIGO South. The idea is that we build the third LIGO interferometer in Australia, outside of Perth, and as opposed to putting it inside the same vacuum system with another interferometer. The scientific case for it is about as slam dunk as you can get. It's not completely slam dunk, but it's almost completely slam dunk. And the major motivation is this. Here is showing the two Hanford detectors, a Louisiana detector and a Virgo detector. And this is the localization of a source at a different place on the sky. And you can see these smudges are the uncertainty in sky localization that you would get with such a network. And it's something like 10 square degrees for a detection. If you can have a out-of-plane detector, you break the degeneracy in the reconstruction, and you generate a sky map that looks more like this. So this is Australia, Hanford, Livingston, and Virgo. The concept for this project comes about, basically assumes that Hanford, Livingston, and Virgo are all operating at comparable sensitivities, and that Australia, particularly the Australian Interferometric Gravity Consortium, can provide all of the infrastructure, buildings, clean rooms, staff necessary for the site. So it would be, one of the key points is that there's no new cost or delay to NSF or the LIGO project. The delay is a little bit interpretable, because the idea is that LIGO South would come online in 2017. That, again, is quite fast. Just to, yes, sir. I will get to that shortly. There was a, to evaluate this committee, this idea, there was an ad hoc LIGO committee that got together, chaired by Ray Weiss, with some self-described skeptics on board to evaluate this. To give you a kind of a more pointed view, this is the reconstruction with the Hanford network of an InSpiral, and you can see this is a few degrees here. This is the reconstruction with the full network. So that's just another pretty picture. The thing that makes this possible is the improved data analysis of the late S5 runs and the S6 runs. This is showing results from Duncan's group that he provided to the committee, showing the trigger rate of the, I'm not sure which network this is, if this includes Virgo. It's H1H2. H1L1. Thank you, Duncan. And what's shown here is backgrounds in black and foregrounds in blue, which, in contrast to previous analyses, the foregrounds had a long tail out here. This means that we can essentially sacrifice H1H2 and not have to rely on that in order to reduce the non-Gaussian backgrounds. That's not completely true, of course, because having that third detector at the same place does greatly reduce your glitch rate, say if you're looking for unmodeled bursts. So here's Hanford, Livingston, and Virgo, here's Australia, Hanford, Livingston, and Virgo. And you can see there's kind of a factor of 10 higher glitch rate, and there's this kind of excess tail here to higher SNR. However, because this is so steep here, the excess you're paying is say going from some number like 3.5 to some number like 4 in terms of signal strength. So that is in view of the committee a penalty that's worth paying in exchange for the improved localization. So that committee met and talked to the NSF. They met on earlier this month, just a few weeks ago. I believe Luis was on the committee, the NSF committee, or at least saw it. So if and only if they return a positive report, then the proposal keeps going up the ladder. Because of the short timeline, they are pushing on kind of the same effort in Australia. They've already done what they believe is a pretty good cost analysis that says that the site and the facilities and all that come up to something like 85 million Australian, which is a nice piece of money if you can get it. The idea is that it would be funded in part by an education investment fund, which is an Australia-wide fund and not physics-specific. However, it obviously needs a lot of commitment from the entire Australian scientific community. So if you know any Australians and you want to help this out, you should send them letters or something. We can lobby Australians. And as Duncan was saying, kind of the most daunting, perhaps, and maybe most exciting aspect of this idea is that in order to avoid impacting LIGO, it's gotta happen by September 30th. And this agreement deadline is meant to include a memoranda of understanding that the funding is in order, that the site has been selected, et cetera. So that's, again, a very aggressive timeline to find that kind of money, for instance. But again, I think the science case is just unassailable. And finally, news just from earlier this week is that LCGT has been funded. And LCGT is the large-scale cryogenic gravitational wave telescope. It's a 3-kilometer interferometer that's in a mine that's meant to go into the Kamiokande mine. The proposal is based on their experience, which they recently presented at the Gravitational Wave Advanced Detector Workshop, with a 100-meter Clio prototype that has been cooled to 20 Kelvin. So this is extremely exciting for all of us. Their basic sensitivities look something like this, where they, because of their improved cryogenics, they reduce the suspension thermal noise to a much more manageable level, allows them to go to low frequencies. You see they're extending down here to some number like 6 or 7 hertz. Again, they're limited by shot noise and radiation pressure. The caveat here, they don't say the range on this plot, I'm sorry, but you can find their website here. Their range is comparable, again, for neutron star to LIGO, advanced LIGO or Virgo. The only caveat in this fantastic news is that they're funded for $109 million of their somewhat larger request. I've heard both $150 million and $200 million was their request. And they were only funded for 3 years. On the other hand, we can hope that people wouldn't fund a project only, a 10-year project only to stop after 3. So we're very hopeful that this will turn into a new detector soon. So I think the future, clearly, for gravitational wave is very bright. Just in the last few weeks, it's become clear that there's a chance for 6 advanced interferometric detectors to come online by, optimistically, 2018, pessimistically by, probably still optimistically, by the end of this decade, with 100 megaparsec neutron star range. LISA technology is going to be in orbit. In 2012, we're going to be doing gravitational studies, although Newtonian gravitational studies, in 2015 with the GRACE-C mission. Pulsar timing looks like it could beat all of us to the punch. and then depending on what nature has to offer in dust and synchrotron radiation and stuff, the Planck mission, when it releases, could be showing evidence of gravitational waves as well. So thank you all very much. I'll take any questions.
For LCGT, I don't have another picture in my mind, but I would have expected, given that they're coming slightly later, that they have this cryogenic, isn't it the noise a bit too high? I mean, the noise curve?
I have, of course, not studied this noise curve in detail either. The short answer is no. they've also clearly not done their they're not nearly as large a collaboration as LIGO. So, for instance, if LIGO were to make this curve today, we would have this curve, which we would call the neutron star tuning, and you notice that it's completely dominated by radiation pressure at low frequencies. They have 800 kilowatts in their arms in this analysis, which is quite impressive. So if they turn that down to 25 kilowatts, they're going to lose a factor of a few at high frequency here, but they're going to get all of this radiation pressure back. And so for, say, a 10 on 1 in spiral, their range will be better than anybody else. It's this number here that they're going cryogenic for, and this number, and maybe even mainly this number. And it's quite impressive if they can do it. I should say it's also quite challenging. Operating a large cryostat next to an ultra-sensitive detector tends to be a little tricky. But that's one of the things that they've demonstrated with Clio, is that they can engineer the cryogenics plant necessary without completely spoiling their environment. The flip side, incidentally, that they've also learned is that going underground into a mine is no panacea. They still see all of the anthropogenic fluctuations in noise and from storms and stuff that we see at any one of our sites. So, on the other hand, it's a very nice environment to work in.
So. What pushes the seismic noise down?
What pushes the seismic noise down? I think in the case of Kamiokande, it's mainly just that it's a very rural site, so there's not a whole lot going on, and it happens to be seismically quiet, but why some places are seismically loud and others are seismically quiet, I don't.
But going underground they're going underground presumably because of space requirements for 3 kilometers in Japan not to be gravity gradient noise?
No, I don't know what the initial what their initial calculus was in them going underground. They don't currently make a lot of claims about gravity gradient noise. The mine is a very nice place to work for other reasons. It's a very thermal, very stable thermally. It is a quiet site. It's just not, amazingly quiet. And then ICRR has got a kind of unique relationship with the Kamioka mine because there's already several large detectors in there for Super K, Camland, one of the other liquid noble gas detectors is there as well. So.
More questions? Then I have another one. Yesterday, the discussion came up about third-generation detectors beyond advanced LIGO. And the question that arose was when the science requirements for these third-generation detectors will be discussed and be settled, and on what time scale the community would have to give input into what signals to go for and what kind of tuning and which frequency ranges.
It's a great question. It's the same question we had for dinner at dinner last night, and I'm afraid I have to claim ignorance on it. I'm not a part of the Einstein telescope. So third generation detectors are starting to be talked about. The Einstein telescope is a European project that was funded for a design study a few years ago. It was mainly a European collaboration that was drawn together from some of the GEO folks and some of the Virgo folks. There is not really a very strong third generation effort in the United States right now. We're focused on advanced LIGO and the extensions to advanced LIGO that look like sort of the enhanced LIGO equivalents. So I'm just afraid that I can't really comment in detail about the Einstein telescope process. I don't know where they're at or who you would talk to. It's still early enough and still pie in the sky enough that your input would be welcome, but how best to direct it, I can't I'm afraid to say.
Could you just flip back to that URL for LGCT for a moment? I've got a web page that's all in Japanese. I'm very good at it. Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, it's actually quite difficult. They've apparently had a press release and a news conference at ICRR to release this. It, of course, went out to all the mailing lists, but then when you actually try and find anything in text anywhere that says funding approved, essentially you can't find anything. So the LCGT website does not yet acknowledge that they've received funding. So, but hopefully it will soon.
Harold, I can channel Peter Solson's, hopefully, answer to your question. In the interest of full disclosure, I'll say that Syracuse and Florida are thinking about a third-generation effort in the U.S., given that there really isn't one at the moment. Peter told me that both initial LIGO and really advanced LIGO were both technology-driven detectors. They were basic. The noise curves for initial LIGO and advanced LIGO were drawn based on what the hardware guys thought they could do. Both of those efforts took 20 years to go from an initial sketch of a noise curve to actually being physical. I mean, advanced LIGO is not quite there yet, but initial LIGO took 20 years from the initial LIGO blue book to actually being a detector, and advanced LIGO is basically the same time scale. So for thinking about third generation detectors, the Einstein Telescope guys are blazing the way, but it needs to be done now if we're going to be ready in 20 years, which is when we're going to need to build this stuff. And it needs to be science case driven this time rather than just drawing noise curves and saying that.
Any other questions? Then let's thank Sim again. And
thank you.
Coffee's upstairs. We are meeting again.